Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to We Dig Metal Evolution, a special Letter Roll Maxi series discussing Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution documentary series, hosted by Nate Wilcox with Eugene S. Robinson of the art punk band Oxbow and entertainment lawyer Alexi Ault. Let It Roll is the insanely ambitious musical history podcast. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi discuss power metal, a genre with roots in the 1970s that became the dominant form of metal in Europe in the 1990s. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we're back again with Alexi Ault and Eugene S. Robinson to continue our discussion of Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution series that aired on VH1 a few years back. The 10th episode focuses on power metal, a genre that Dunn traces back to Ronnie James Dio and Rainbow, but many believe started with Helloween and Manowar in the 80s before exploding in popularity in Europe in the late 1990s. Fellas, power metal, had you heard of it? Anybody? Anybody? Alexi?
Yes, Dragon Force.
Man, this was tough. This was tough, man. It was tougher than tough than tough. I don't know. I thought the last one was tough, but for some reason, this to me, what Dunn dropped the ball on is that he really needed to be talking about why this didn't succeed or wasn't as big of a deal in America as it was in Europe, much like Eurovision, much like this thing called disco polo. These are purely European phenomena that haven't made their way back here in any way, shape, or form. But yeah, I mean, I guess now with the singing shows, with the competitions, but this was tough, man. Outside of accepting the ones that rose above the froth, and you know, connecting it to Dio is one way to get us interested, because I'm an obsessive Dio fan. But this is some weird concatenation of, you know, totalitarianism and urge for it.
This is how the Germans do it. We have
drunkenness. Yeah, I love this band. I just love them, love them, love them.
Oh, when the Fräuleins are at the side. In the festivals.
No. But I mean, you know.
They have some cuties, though. I have to say, of all of the music forms, when they had certain things in the crowd, like, you know, there's a certain time when they had glam metal and things were popping, you know, I got to tip my hat off to them is the fact that, you know, they tried to have some kind of, you know, cuties in the crowd and on stage, that one girl on the stage with the tambourine.
Yeah, you mean, oh, so you talk about women in the band.
Band and the crowd.
Yeah.
And the one woman on stage he's referring to was just apparently a dancer, from what I could tell. She didn't have a mic or anything and was just sort of there you know, like the waitress at a...
She had a tambourine. Come on, man. Stop downplaying her skills.
Linda McCartney.
I had been completely oblivious to this genre, although I had heard the term power metal, but apparently misapplied to that whole era from Judas Priest, Scorpions, Rainbow, all the way up to Anvil.
They're trying to associate themselves with people who, in other words, the category is weaker without the roughshod inclusions. I'm not including Dio there. I'm not including Judas Priest here. Dunn did that to make it significant, you know. I may not even include Accept there, you know. Okay, Helloween, yeah. And he's trying to fit true metal in there with Manowar. Joey DeMaio didn't even want to be interviewed for this section, right? So it's not like... It's like a European version of nu metal somehow. I don't know how to describe it.
Well, it's almost the opposite of nu metal. To me, it seems like this was what
I'm talking
popular
about
in lieu of nu metal.
It's culty. It's culty kind of non-musical attraction. It didn't really... I mean, look, it's a great music for a singer. I wish our fans... so I could just stand there and go, yeah, you sing it.
It's not too late to put out a Schlager album and just go full on sing along. The beer halls, you know, are rowdy and fun. I don't know. I think that the my understanding of the term was that it was sort of a retroactively applied term because you needed something to describe metal between, say, 77 and 83, pre-speed metal, but post-Judas Priest, or Judas Priest and everything until Metallica, because that was just called heavy metal. I mean, that was the era when heavy metal was heavy metal and the bands adopted the term. Like Sabbath, Deep Purple, all those guys, that was a new term. They didn't necessarily like it. Mm. Judas Priest took the term on as a point of pride all the way up through Iron Maiden. You know, bands were like, what are you? We're a metal band. So this, you know, in 1982, Iron Maiden was just heavy metal. But after you have thrash, you have death metal, and you've got black metal, and you've got stoner metal and all this stuff, you need a way to categorize what kind of metal is this. And I think that's kind of where power metal got retroactively. And I think it's a perfectly good term. You know,
yeah,
perfectly
good. But how are you going to talk about Yngwie Malmsteen without talking about Alcatraz, right? Like he's just been doing this Paganini thing the whole time without talking. I mean, he got famous because of Alcatraz, not the other
way
around.
We'll get to Yngwie.
Okay. All right.
So we'll come to Yngwie. Yeah. And the other group that they left out of this was Europe, because
yes,
as much as like listening to some of these newer bands, I had much more fun listening to this than the nu metal stuff. Nu metal, I find, with all the whispering voices and all the talk about childhood trauma and everything, like,
I don't
know. If you're not in board with it, it's not much fun. But this stuff is just ridiculous. And so I hooted and hollered all the way through it. To varying degrees, some of the stuff I thought was pretty good. And I was also kind of impressed by how much of it is post, not just post speed metal, but I mean, some of the stuff was as fast as black metal. And a lot of the stuff that I had liked so much about black metal, I'm realizing, oh wow, power metal bands were doing it at the same time or just a little bit later. All the classical influences, they just had good production values and, you know, weren't quite as evil. But some of the stuff was just totally ridiculous, you know, which was fun.
Did it seem strange to you that they spent a sizable portion of the show talking about what people were wearing? I think that points to a weakness in the music.
I don't know. I think that's part of the whole thing. I mean, this appears to be something that got popular at these festivals, which seem to be big help. And it's like a cross between a German traditional beer garden and a Renaissance
medieval times
fair. Yeah, yeah, it's the Renaissance fair aspect is.
I will sell you many vests, and I defy you to get them home and play them on your stereo, your cassette player, or your CD player. These are non-musical appurtenances that it's just we're not talking about music anymore, right? It's significant, and Dio himself appears, and he just like Dio, like now you know, just got a T-shirt on, hanging out, being Dio.
Well, he wasn't on stage. You know, I mean,
no, he had him on stage with just a white shirt, dress shirt. Could have gotten in that shirt.
But I mean, Rob Halford went full tilt,
leather spikes,
the whole bit. And that, you know, Accept definitely did that. That was a whole thing. To me, it was more a matter of they should have focused more on the Scorpions and Judas Priest earlier in the series. That the way they pigeoned, you know, like we just dropped that first UK heavy metal episode. And to me, squeezing Judas Priest into that didn't fit. Like Judas Priest to me is a whole different era from Sabbath, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, etc. And I'm glad they did finally get to the Scorpions, because the Scorpions are a big deal. And this whole, I mean, this show was huge. I mean, like Blind Guardian sold and Hammerfall sold gazillions of records. So even if it is just a European thing, it's still a pretty big thing. Yeah, so did the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I mean, you know, I'm not
the self-indulgence.
I'm not here to judge. You guys are here to judge. I'm just trying to understand what happened. You know,
you're Switzerland.
Yeah, if something's popular, I'm like, what's the deal here? You know,
but not above selling that taken and hoarding that Holocaust gold, huh?
That's right. Yeah, Nazi gold.
I wish somebody was giving me Nazi gold to listen to power metal albums, but I'm doing it for free. I'm even paying to do it with Spotify.
You're not paying.
You know, I mean, it's a reasonable monthly subscription, right?
You said like, paying close to pain. Pain.
But let's get back to trying to summarize the show. So Sam Dunn is basically scratching his head and like, what is this stuff? Like, he's about our age. This is new to him. And wasn't his scene, and he's just kind of baffled by what's going on. I would be very curious as to know why was this given an episode. I assume because it was popular in the 2000s, and the show was made around 2011 or so.
And you got to justify the trips.
Yeah, you got.
How do I get to the Alps?
And I did find it sort of compelling that it was another reaction to grunge. That grunge made metal passé. Actually, metal made metal passé.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it just got so big in the 80s and so lame. And you had bands like Europe and just ad nauseum, you know, and people just got tired of it. And grunge, you know, kind of cleared the decks. But like we talked about alt metal stuff, you know, like your dreaded Red Hot Chili Peppers and Jane's Addiction and Living Color and all that actually ended up being more of an influence on metal, on the future metal, at least through new metal. But in Europe, it was a different branch of metal that came back. And so this was a reaction of just people being tired of the whole Kurt Cobain po-faced, everything's got to be so serious, no fun costumes, no sing-alongs. And then, you know, Hammerfall comes along and we've got costumes, we've got sing-alongs, we've got symphonic guitar players, you know, we've got solos.
Like, it kind of reminded me of hip-hop, like the certain era in which the whole idea was the stage show and how the people had the flashy clothes and the choreographed dance moves. But then it got to a point where, like, I'm not dancing, I'm just looking mean on stage. And
gangsters don't dance.
Right, and there's all... And the hearkening back to that era. So, I mean, I did find it interesting to see, like, as much as it seemed like it was filler and grasping, it was interesting to see what happens when there is a certain genre of music that's passé, but the people haven't passéed it. You know, the fact that they're still holding on to it, like, hey, wait a second, I kind of miss this kind of stuff, or I never gave it up. I'm going to keep on doing it. I'm going to keep on listening to it. We're actually going to not, instead of having pure tribute bands, we're going to continue to create and create and create and create and create. And then you have this whole world again, the whole Dungeons and Dragons. That's why just watching the episode, it was thoroughly entertaining, because there's so many, and I saw with my wife, she's like, oh my God, these dorks. Oh, can you imagine? I said, well, what would happen if I mentioned, I said, honey, there's a, I'd like to introduce you to a special kind of music I listen to.
There'd be no honey.
I also think that the millennial generation had no beef with geeks. Like geekery became cool in that generation. They were raised on video games. They were raised on Dungeons and Dragons, and there was no shame in it. They were just like, this is cool and it's fun and we're into it and this is what we do. And so these kids, you know, coming up with the metal and way into the fantasy aspect. And I mean, some of these bands have like 5-part concept albums about some emerald sword, and they're basically writing a whole fantasy novel except as a concept album.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you because of the dog.
Sorry, there's not a lot I can do with it. Fucking idiot. But you know, it's to me it's like a lot of the stuff like the twee rock that came out around the same time, like Belle and Sebastian and the
December. Oh my god, that's kind of something.
Of course you hate it because you're macho and tough and everything, but
I tried to listen.
I mean,
what were some of the big songs from those people, that stuff?
Yeah, name the hit for Bell's best hit.
The Magnetic Field 69 Love Songs is the one that gets, like, they never had hit singles in any of that kind of stuff.
Magnetic Fields is different.
Sinister. I mean, there's all these bands are different. Like,
I talked to Gerard Cosloy, interviewed him, and I said, now that I got you, explain Bell and Sebastian to me. He goes, I can't.
And he put out there. I dig Bell and Sebastian. I'm an unabashed Bell and Sebastian fan. And it's totally wimpy and fey and twee and the whole thing.
It goes along with the roller blades that you have at home, right?
The little brother, the big brother dynamic is coming on hard in this episode, man.
But my point was that those bands weren't doing anything technically or formally innovative. But what they were doing was these elaborate, whatever. I mean, if you're not into it, you're not into it. But they were doing these elaborate, you know, concept albums and big arranged pieces and going back into stuff that had been pioneered in the early 70s and then kind of dropped. And then they went back to all the art rock stuff and it was like, a concept album about states, like stuff Jim Stevens did. You know, he announces he's going to do a 50 albums concept series for each state. He does two states, but whatever. But I think that power metal is kind of in that same way where they're not formally innovating. You know, musically, everything they're doing is like combinations of speed metal and, symphonic metal and prog rock. But they're doing these elaborate, a five-part concept album about the Emerald Sword, that's pretty ambitious. And the fact that there's an audience for it, you know, like when I was playing Dungeons and Dragons, people like Eugene would come along and dunk your head in the toilet if you made a mistake of bringing your Dungeons and Dragons stuff to school. I mean, it was known to be a shameful thing and something you should be embarrassed about. And the millennials didn't seem to have that. Like they seem to just embrace games.
Hold on. That's unfair characterization. I used to live in a trailer with guys who played Dungeons and Dragons the entire weekend. And every time I walked through, I would go, they go, Eugene, you want to play? I go, excuse me, I'm going to go out and have some sex now. Good day, sir. And I would leave that.
Well, so are we. We're going to have a sex campaign. There's some female orcs and they're so hot.
I don't want to get into a sideline about the Society for Creative Anachronism, but they used to meet at the tennis courts my house, and apparently it's a whole wife swapping scene based on who wins the sword fights. So
the sword fight.
They're seriously out there with armor.
Yes,
I bet they are serious out there wielding swords,
playing swords, and we used to get high and watch it. Hours. It was definitely the highlight of every Tuesday evening to watch those dorks.
I had some friends who were into that. Man, it was rough. It became like the Dog Brothers. Like they were actually really trying to kill each other. So I was like, all right.
Yeah, cool. And it got to where it was clearly fairly big dudes who could handle a sword. I mean, they caught us laughing at him, and they were like, you know, inviting us to play. We're like, oh no, thanks.
you're wise enough to fall for that.
But back to the show. So he introduces the concept of power metal. He's scratching his head as to what is this stuff. People are telling him, you know, it's heavy, it's European, it's sing-alongs, big emphasis on melody, big emphasis on virtuosity, symphonic, heavy classical influences, and heavy Dungeons & Dragons influence. Then he takes it back and focuses again on Dio, which I think needed to be done. Dio and Rainbow... like I said earlier, they should have had a whole episode from like 75 to 80 or 82 or whatever that covered that period. Another thing about Dio is Dio's a guy who made what? Six classic albums, except that two or three of them were with Rainbow, which was Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow. So Rainbow's already a spinoff of Deep Purple. Right. And Dio's introduced there to the broader public. Then he does two albums with Black Sabbath after Ozzy is fired. Classic albums, revise the band. It's different. It's not original Black Sabbath. It's Dio Black Sabbath, and it's awesome. Then he does at least two really good albums on his own. So his brand is just Yeah, Holy Diver, classic album. But that eroded his brand value because he didn't have one band that's the band with all six, you know, all of his masterworks in one place. So I'm glad to see him getting some shine. And I don't know, I always found that the Dio lyrics just utterly ridiculous and hilarious.
And, oh, no.
Well, tell us your whole theory about the serious side of Dio, because it was just fun. I mean,
I was scheduled to interview Dio, and this came out of, I was turned on to Dio by Henry Rollins, but I had ignored his stuff in Rainbow and Sabbath, right? I paid attention to stuff before, new singer, I hear new, wasn't interested. Rollins goes, we've been listening to this all summer, haven't been able, gave me Holy Diver. And it was my last summer at school, and I spent the entire summer taking LSD and listening to Holy Diver. There was nothing else I was listening to. So I saw all kinds of different levels and shadings of meanings. And, I had figured that he was deep into the occult and tracked him down to do an interview. And he did not disappoint. I was on the way to the interview, and I had a pager. This is how old it was, a pager. Not even, so please call. And I was at the building where I was supposed to interview him, and they were like, do not go into the building. He apparently had some sort of paranoid flip out, and like, you can't, they're after him, they're out to get him. So he was a real driven, riven, strange cat. And then as it turns out, years later, the day he died, we ended up being like Eskimo brothers in a really weird way. It was just, Dio, you have to listen to his lyrics to understand. It's not just, it's only been an hour since they locked her in the tower. It's not just fantasy stuff, which he kind of tried to minimize. If you read, we're talking about thelemic stuff. We're talking about satanic, Crowley-esque, deep satanic stuff that was all throughout his lyrics, which he firmly believed in. But, he just figured out, much like Russell Simmons once said about a Slick Rick record, he goes, it's not like there are lots of songs about anal sex on the record. And he laughed. And of course, there's a song about anal sex on the record.
Well,
Dio, they ask him about the imagery, and he goes, oh, no, this is a very Christian record. Well, of course, Satan is a very Christian concept. Doesn't mean it wasn't satanic. So I didn't listen to Dio and laugh at all. I saw that there was a lot of stuff happening there. And, seen him live multiple times, and that's been confirmed by everything I saw live, which I thought it was a disservice to take that dead man, that great dead man, and put him in the same thing with, the sing-along Germans.
But they were clearly influenced by him. I mean, he was one of their favorites, and you don't get to pick who's influenced by you.
Well,
Red
Hot Chili Peppers might say that they were influenced by George Clinton, but if I'm watching a George Clinton documentary, I don't really want to see anything about the Chili Peppers in it, right?
Showing your age again. Closed minds, closed out for the new. Because if you get into Reddit, look at Reddit. People are way into this stuff. I mean, there is a big audience for it. They take it seriously. They heavily discuss it. They're evaluating the different albums. I mean, this is a legit scene. I don't think you get to just dismiss it.
How many people who on that Reddit page are from America? Maybe.
I mean,
It seems to me distinctly like a distinctly European phenomenon. I don't know.
Does that make it not legit? I mean,
not at all. But it explains why I don't understand it. No, I mean, there's stuff that comes out of America that nobody understands, right? I mean, Europeans, of which I'm married to one, is always just asking me about stuff that Americans do, and she just can't figure it out, right? It's like, what is it with you guys and guns?
My father's been here since he was 19. He said, I still don't understand Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand Americans, and, I am one.
Being self-hating is totally different than being an outsider coming in.
You're from Texas. That doesn't count.
I know. I mean, it's just like, it's just like watching the Oliver Stone hearings and going, away, this guy's a crook. And then going to school the next day and everybody's got an Oliver Stone t-shirt, or not Oliver Stone, Oliver North, and it's just like saluting the flag. I mean, it's just like, totally not. Let's get back on track. So then they talk about Judas Priest and Rob Halford, because again, continuing the legacy of Dio and even more operatic singing. They also talk about the twin guitars of Judas Priest, which I don't believe they mentioned the first time they talked about Judas Priest. And Glenn Tipton and KK Downing totally deserve the shine. Although, they totally leave out Queen. No Freddie Mercury, no Rob Halford. It's that simple. Freddie Mercury absolutely was a legit... I mean, he did opera singing towards the end of his life. He was a legit opera caliber singer. Queen was massively classically influenced, and very heavy for their time. And also, no Thin Lizzy, no Judas Priest. Thin Lizzy absolutely pioneered that harmonized twin guitar thing, took the Allman Brothers style and applied it to heavy metal or heavy rock. Yeah. Thin Lizzy's kind of iffy as far as being heavy metal, but they definitely got over with the heavy rock crowd in a big way. And the Judas Priest twin guitar thing, I mean, you can track it. When did the Thin Lizzy albums come out and when did Judas Priest start doing that stuff? It's totally clear. I'm not trying to minimize Judas Priest because I way prefer them to Iron Maiden. I think they are the definitive metal band. I mean, Black Sabbath's like the metal band, but then Judas Priest makes it heavy metal, Black Sabbath's more heavy. So I'm not trying to diss Judas Priest. I'm just saying they left some stuff out. Then they come back to Iron Maiden, which, again, totally fair. I think this stuff is clearly influenced by Iron Maiden. Once again, you got heavy melody influence, virtuosic playing, and the fantasy style, the big epics again. Although Iron Maiden's epics tended to be more historical or whatever, and not so much the Dungeons and Dragons fantasy stuff. Then they finally get to the Scorpions, which I understand why the Scorpions were hard to shoehorn into this stuff, because they had a really bizarre career. Did you guys ever pay much attention to the Scorpions? Because they essentially had three or four different periods. They have this early period with Michael Schenker on lead guitar. Then they have this middle period with Uli John Roth, because UFO poached Michael Schenker. And UFO doesn't even get a mention in this series, which was a pretty serious, British hard rock band in the later 70s. Then they get Uli John Roth, who is this total Jimi Hendrix acolyte. And he's great, but if you listen to some of those old Scorpion albums, he'll be quoting Hendrix licks. You're Mad at Rage of the Machine for ripping off a Bad Brains melody. Uli John Roth was taking just entire Hendrix melody.
Well, Hendrix was dead, so I don't mind. The Bad Brains are still alive, and so they could use a check from Rage Against the Machine.
So if Bad Brains dies and there's a new group called Rad Grains, you're like, oh, that's different.
maybe not.
I mean,
vegan punk and reggae.
But there's this whole period when they were huge in Europe and trying to get over in the States, and they did all these pretty solid hard rock heavy metal albums. Then Uli John Roth quits. They try to bring back Michael Schenker. They bring in Matthias Jabs because Schenker's too drug addict up to play anymore. Then they have their Van Halen era where they're MTV stars. And they're clearly ripping off Van Halen and Def Leppard. And, Rocky Like a Hurricane. They have some classic MTV era hits. But anyway, it's hard to
figure out. But you can't separate them from 1989, buddy.
Oh, the classic, song about the wall falling down, but that has nothing to do with heavy metal. I mean,
here we stand as brothers.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that just made me turn up the Tokyo tapes and just block out, this 1980s Scorpions never happened. I'm about the 70s Scorpions. And the 70s Scorpions, the other fun thing about them was they had multiple album covers that were censored because they had naked underage girls on the cover and shit like that.
Yeah,
it's very Spinal Tap-esque. I mean, totally tasteless, utterly.
Whipping Boy's drummer was from Augsburg, Germany. I mean, he was an Afro-German or whatever they call biracial people from Germany. And he was the one who actually had a copy of the pre-censored Virgin Killer. And I remember looking at it in 1982 and just going, what the fuck is wrong with Germans? I mean, I don't know if you've seen the cover, but it's they had to go through a whole bunch of people before it hit the marketplace. And nobody said
And that was an American record company that greenlighted that. I mean, you know, it's worse than the Blind Faith album cover. It's worse than Houses of the Holy. I mean, it is the most offensive rock record cover of all time, I would say. I mean, it was incredible. You cannot sell it in a store these days. It would be, you could go to jail for having that photo, you know, on your computer. There was a
band in Slovenia, and I blocked out the name. I was friends with the people in the band, and they were super excited, and they sent me their record, and it was really pro, really well done, high quality photos, and because I pick it up from the back, and then, you know, I turn over to the front, and it's a woman who's been stabbed in the vagina with a knife and is bleeding. It's mostly a white cover, so you just see her ass with a knife sticking out of it and blood trailing. And I was like, the fuck are you guys thinking?
Is this a photograph or a drawing?
It's a photograph, man. A photograph. I go, why don't, and they said, well, what did you think of the record? And I go, we got to talk about the 800-pound fucking gorilla. What the fuck are you doing with the cover? The music is great. Would you? Well, you know, the guitar player thought. I go, well, we just thought you could, maybe we could tour with you. I go, nah, this is our conversation stopping now. You're into censorship. I'm not censoring anything. This is ridiculous. It's so bad. But that's how I felt when I saw Virgin Killer.
It's, you know, it's extremely offensive by any measure. But that's a side note. I mean, the Scorpions were massively influential, and they really proved that a German band could make it big in America.
Yes. They had,
you know, a huge, enormous influence.
With a balding lead singer.
Yes.
Because that's what stood out to me, is like, that guy's bald. What the fuck?
There were more, I mean, you know, plenty of metal singers that were going bald. The guy from Quiet Riot was
Frankie Oh, yeah, Dubrow, yeah, yeah, yes, 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 yes.
Kevin Dubrow. Yes, he was infamous for his hairpiece, like, moving down his forehead.
His name was Brow. He's trying to stay true to the name.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, but
first time I saw Tool, Maynard still had hair, but it was like, he looked like Frankenfooter from Rocky Horror Picture Show, but he got rid of it quickly, thankfully.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I mean, it's something that happens even to someone like myself. So, you know, I mean, it happens, but not everybody goes for the full Ben Franklin and grows it out anyway. But we'll continue. We got more power metal to talk about. We're going to talk about Accept, and then get into Man of War and Helloween, and then into Blind Guardian and the whole German revival. And I swear, Eugene, check out Blind Guardian. They're not that bad. I mean, they're
no. I got stuff. Hello. I've listened to Helloween, and I'm.
Well, Helloween's like, knows,
I'm a Man of War fan.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that next time, because, and also that's the era when they grow up with speed metal, and they had to hang with Slayer and Metallica and all that stuff, and that's when this stuff gets a lot heavier than Iron Maiden, and Judas Priest, because a lot of these fans totally laugh at Sam Dunn for trying to include Rainbow and the Scorpions and Judas Priest in this episode. And we'll continue when we come back.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And we're continuing our discussion of power metal. Now we turn from the Scorpions to Accept, the German band that took things even heavier than the Scorpions. I like this. I've always been a big fan of Udo, Dirk Schneider, and I loved the way he summed up the band and that we were going to be heavier than the Scorpions, and we were. And the other thing we did was synchronized guitar movements. That, to me,
that's
a tiny bit of a disservice to the Accept legacy. But Hammerfall picks up on it and says, you know, if you look at Hammerfall live, you'll understand the Accept influence because of the synchronized guitar movements. But they didn't bring up the Shadows, the British guitar band featuring Hank Marvin that backed up Cliff Richard in the days before the Beatles. They too did the synchronized guitar movements. Just sans the black leather.
Listen,
camo.
Listen, as far as I know, when the Rolling Stones appeared on Saturday Night Live and Mick Jagger started licking Ron Wood's face on or about his nose and mouth, they never addressed that in the press. It never came up again. Like, nobody ever said, hey, isn't that a little strange? You're just licking the guy's face. It just never came up. Oh, you know, conversely, I think this is some stuff you don't talk about. Talking about synchronized movements in heavy metal.
I see you.
You're not angry with him. You're not angry with him. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Harry Shearer, man. But since that commenter, I'm trying to be more positive about this stuff. So,
well, good. Thank you. Much appreciated. I mean, the thing with that is, I don't think our opinions really matter. I don't view music criticism as particularly valid, except when people are talking about stuff they love because they love it, not because they got a big stack of CDs in the mail and they're trying to pick a winner. So we're just trying to talk about the history here. And yeah, it's kind of an ugly history in parts, but except...
And you said that. I did it.
Yeah, you know, but what they don't go into is Accept never made it in the States, because of homophobia. Like that Balls to the Wall album, which was basically the same album cover as the first Motley Crue album, you know, a dude's crotch in leather pants, except it's called Balls to the Wall, and the singer is just Rob Halford, but two notches gayer on the gay scale, you know? I don't know if Udo's gay or not. I don't care, but I definitely think that people in the 80s in the States did, I think that hurt except.
An interesting question is, do you think they were consciously playing with gay identity issues, or do you think that they were just mindless of it, right? Heedless of it.
I don't see how you could be. The thing.
Well, hold on. If those legs on the cover and that crotch in the cover were Udo's legs and crotch, that's a totally different story than what was actually on the cover, which was some super buff dude. A little bit different.
So you're saying if Udo had been more buff, he would have been more popular?
No, I'm saying if Udo, buff or not, if Udo had been on the cover, much like Man of War, then it makes sense. This is not the same patina that you get with Man of War, because it's Man of War, right? You see what I'm saying? Mm. Halford is Halford. Man of War is Man of War. They hired a model for that cover.
I don't know. I was always sort of baffled by my meathead friends and their love of Judas Priest. Freddie Mercury got a little bit of pushback, and Queen, although plenty of the meatheads liked him, but except would consistently get homophobic remarks from my goon friends. I mean, consistently. And I think it was the album cover and the song title. I mean, Balls to the Wall would always break out, you know, the 12-year-olds in my crew in giggles. So, you know, but well, for whatever reason.
Go ahead. It was like about a cop thing, about getting arrested. I think the thing was Udo in choosing Camel. There are a couple of things. That wasn't him on the cover. If it was him on the cover, it would be kind of badass. It wasn't him on the cover, and he was dressed in camo gear, which at that point, you got to remember, the only public reference you would have had to that would have been something Village People-esque. So it's a very couple of steps. And then, of course, Cruising broke. And so these...
Cruising didn't break very big. You're referring to the Al Pacino movie of the early 80s.
Correct.
Which
apparently
you saw many times, but most people... just let slide,
great movie,
you know.
Actually great. Well, there were a big protest in New York about the movie. People were outraged about it. So
I think
gay community,
you know, I think back in the day, going to, you know, when I saw the video back in the day, right? Because I think there are different levels to it. They did their levels to this shit.
And what were you, like, 8?
So what was it, 1983, right?
Yeah,
so I was 11.
Okay,
so I wasn't, my first introduction to a lot of stuff was either on the radio, somebody, at that age, the radio, somebody has a tape, you know, you borrow a tape, or a music video, right? It's one of those threes. So for one of those three. So for Accept, I saw the video first. And for me, in my homophobic mind back in the day, I wasn't looking at it as like, I wasn't picking, the thing that threw me off wasn't that, and again, it's from an 11-year-old, right? It wasn't homophobia, it was just that the lead singer just didn't seem to fit what my conception of a heavy metal or hard singer was. There was something that looked off about him in the sense that, like,
he was short.
No, just foreign. The camo and his hairstyle, it didn't match. So again, as an 11-year-old, in terms of if there's a certain kind of, if I'm looking at musicians and I'm boxing them and putting them in categories, right? And like, who do I look at as like, wow, that guy's cool, right? Or oh, that guy's scary, or that guy's this, right? So if I'm categorizing him, he just looked weird, and he just did not, I don't want to say foreign, my father was Jamaican, so it's not like I had a xenophobia. He just didn't look like the guy from Scorpions. He looked old and balding. So I remember as a kid looking at guys like, man, that guy looks like he's bald, right? So as a kid, he threw me off because he looked bald. The guy from Quiet Riot looked like he was balding, but the rest of their getup was consistent with my young mind's notion of this is what like Judas Priest. This is what
about Rob Halford?
This is what Rob Halford. No, he was balding, but his whole getup was consistent with this is a metal guy. This is a rock guy. The guy from Accept. I didn't know where he came from. It looked weird. There was nobody.
It was a stylistic failure.
Right. Total stylistic failure. And again, I'm not talking about like as a metalhead. I'm just talking about as an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
You watch a video and you see something that either attracts you, scares you, turns you off, or confuses you. It confused me because, again, stylistically speaking, he didn't look like the members of his band. He wasn't dressed like them. He just stood out for all the wrong reasons. And it wasn't homophobia, it's just that he looked more like a G.I. Joe character than he looked like a heavy metal guy.
The metalheads liked him. I mean, Accept was over with the real hardcore.
Right, but I'm saying as a non-hardcore, because to a certain degree, when you talk about Motley Crue and you talk about all these other things, like there's certain groups that for hardcores and music critics, like rub them one way or the other way, no pun intended, but as a total casual, those individuals who you watch as a casual, especially as a kid, and resonate with you or your friends on a visceral level, right? There's some people that you watch and it's like, they scare this. Like Motley Crue, for instance. You look at Motley Crue because I was a church-going guy, seeing all the pentagrams and shit, like I was like, what the fuck is – like it seemed evil, right? When I saw Iron Maiden – or when you hear Judas Priest, like Judas, right? It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like the whole – Hotel California, and someone saying, well, did you know that if you blow up the window, there's a demon in the corner window, right? Shit like that. So then when you have this guy that looks like he just walked off a Yo Joe, like a G.I. Joe character, it's more of this confused, like, who's this guy? And then you hear him talk, and it's like, what country is he from? You know, just, and this is from a person who's into international stuff.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think I was 21 when the record came out, and the guy who gave me the record introduced me to a lot of cool heavy metal of that, you know, that ilk. But when he gave me the Accept record, there was a quiet moment where he goes, I want you to listen to this. And I look at the cover. He handed it to me. I look at the cover. I go, cool. He goes, I think you'll like it. And I was like, cool. Cool, I'll listen to it, man. He goes,
and your eyes met, and next thing you know,
you know what's so cool about that cover photo is, you know, if you want to, like, for instance, you know, if I take out my nutsack, right? Give me your hand.
Recruiting.
Or if you feel better with it, you know, you take out your nutsack and I'll.
Exactly. Uh-huh. But I was willing to listen to it. I liked it.
And it was kicking. I mean, you know, but then they didn't really have a follow-up, and they just never blew up. I think you basically had one bite at the apple in the States. They didn't make it, and they kind of fell back. And then the next band they go and talk about is Helloween, which I think they should have talked about Yngwie first because he historically came before Helloween. So that kind of threw me, but we'll stick with their model. Talk about Helloween, which is an obvious thing because it's the next German band. It's definitely power metal, the same sort of stuff. It's got the swords and sorcery, Dungeons and Dragons lyrical theme, but it's updated. They were, you know, except influenced the thrash bands, but Helloween was influenced by the thrash band, so they were faster and a little bit harder. Although at the time I remember, like, I loved all the thrash bands, but there were bands like Grim Reaper or whatever that were kind of power metal that came along a little late, and I was like, this isn't making it. And it was my dorky friend who had the cassette, and Helloween was like controversial because it basically fit in with thrash, but it still had these cheesy metal stuff that we would goof on Helloween pretty hard. Like,
and you could start with the name.
It's a pun, you know. I wouldn't recommend making a second language pun, basically, for your band name. They're going for hell and Halloween, but like my kid this week was like, hello ween, you know.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Exactly. I was like, okay, yeah, you know, that was a bit of a bad name. But going back and listening to them in this context, because I have not thought about Halloween in 30 years, I thought that was pretty solid stuff. Once you get over this is going to be goofy, it's going to be Dungeons and Dragons, you know, and the two, the Keeper albums, I mean, they went a whole hog with the concept albums and the plots and everything. And clearly they laid some seed, because all the bands we're going to be talking about the rest of this episode, with the exception of Yngwie, are the descendants of Helloween and Manowar. And I felt like I should have talked about, go ahead.
I can't even countenance actually just talking about Yngwie separate from what broke Yngwie in my mind, which is a great Alcatraz. I just, it's like, you know, I'm still Yngwie. And I mean, oh, you mean the guitar player for Alcatraz? Because it's like, you know, Graham Bonnet, I love them so much that they were, you know, Yngwie was a nice ad, but I never followed Yngwie after Alcatraz.
See, because that's crazy. You're the only person I've ever known who was into Alcatraz. I was aware of Alcatraz because I read Guitar Player magazine, and they were featured in Guitar Player magazine like every month because of Yngwie, yep. And they had ads in there. But I barely saw an Alcatraz. I remember seeing the Alcatraz bin empty in the record store, and a friend of mine had a copy of the cassette, and it was Graham Bonnet, who was the replacement for Dio and Rainbow. That was a singer, and he puts together this band Alcatraz. I can't remember what label they were on, but it was like a semi-janky label. But he, after he had Yngwie, after he had Yngwie, he replaced him with Steve Vai. So he was clearly going for that, you know, like, I was in a band with Ritchie Blackmore. I'm going to be in a band with a hotshot guitar player. This is the formula. And so, yeah, so Yngwie, that was Yngwie's biggest exposure in the States, was the band Alcatraz, which they don't mention at all. But Yngwie was one of these guys, to me, that was just a joke among my circle of friends. Like, we would just make, he was the epitome of the hair metal guy who plays too fast, who has no taste or sense or whatever. But then when I get to college and me and my punk rock friends are goofing on Yngwie, and my metalhead roommate was like, oh, shut up, assholes, Yngwie has soul. And we're like, no, he doesn't. He just twiddly, twiddly, twiddly. And my roommate, who later became a really good friend, although initially we were like punk and metal, like Oil and Water or whatever, you know, he puts on an Yngwie track and shut us up because it was undeniably some soulful playing. And so I didn't ever like dive into Yngwie, but I was like, okay, you know, maybe I shouldn't talk about music I don't know well, because, you know, it's got these hidden secrets.
Which would cover the show, actually.
Yes. But then there's two bits in the Yngwie segment that I thought really got to the heart of Yngwie. The first one was Sam Dunn, who's clearly put out because he's been chasing Yngwie from castle to castle all over Europe. And as yet another, you know, we were supposed to go to a castle, but he's not going to be at the castle, so we've got to meet him in the lobby of this hotel, blah, blah, blah. And he says, he's a bit of a legend. He kind of knows he's a legend. That's part of the problem. He's very aware of it, his legendness. So, his legendness. So Yngwie is very aware of his legendness. And, you know, then they show him twiddly, twiddly, playing really fast. But I loved when I talked to his keyboard player, Jens Johansson, who's like, we would often sit and get drunk and listening to Paganini, which was his favorite. And I would be like, Paganini sucks. Bach is much better. Listen to this. And then he plays it. And Yngwie would go, yeah, it is better, but Paganini's faster.
I'm shocked they left the Florida hotel room freak out, because that was like he was doing Tom Petty shit in the hotel room in Florida. Got an argument with a girlfriend, punched the wall, broke his hand. It was almost the end for Yngwie, right? Do you remember this? Am I the only one who remembers this?
I remember this, but I mean, I think all they wanted to get across with Yngwie was he was European. He was big in Europe, and he really went over the top with the classical stuff. Like, they show him with an orchestra and the whole bit. And I always thought that that was some sort of desecration of classical music until I got to know classical music a little better. No. Paganini was Yngwie. I mean, dudes playing fast and loud was what classical music, a big chunk of what classical music was all about back in the day. You know, I mean,
you don't even have to go. You don't even have to go back then. I know people who were first chair, second chair in symphonies. Out of their minds, man. Out of their minds. Worse than any rock guy I've ever hung out with. You know, I mean, and exactly. I mean, from every point of view. So,
yeah, it's like what I remember in college partying with some family friends of my ex-wife, and one of them was a ballet dancer, and one of them was some kind of symphonic I can't remember what he played, but these were goons. These were meathead goons. And I was just, wait, you're a ballerina. And they nearly killed me for calling him a ballerina. And he was, and I quickly realized, whoa, ballerinas, dude, ballerinas are real big and strong.
Like, yeah. You know? They got to be hoisting, telling you.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't pick on gymnasts and you don't pick on ballet dancers like that. No, that's a bad bet. No. So anyway, They cover Yngwie, then they go back to Man of War. And to me, Man of War and Halloween should have been covered at the same time because they were contemporary. They were different, you know, but also similar. Like Man of War was in that same boat where they weren't quite thrash, but they could hang with the thrash bands. They were sold, you know, the same magazines, the thrash magazines would have Metallica, Slayer, Anthrax, and Halloween and Man of War in there. But I think what it was the whole cheesiness aspect. This Conan the Barbarian fetish they had always made them seem just clownish to me. And their music was more dramatic. Like the dude and the thing says, it's the drama of Rainbow and very Iron Maiden influence. So it was clearly going in a different direction, but I didn't have a word for it. I didn't know what power metal, there wasn't a thing called power metal then, even though the music had been...
Man of War, I remember. Okay, I don't know what your initial exposure was, but my initial exposure was, okay, they're from Queens, so right away as a New York guy, I'm paying attention, and then I see photos and I start clowning them, and they follow that pretty quickly with, I mean, that's the kind of thing where if you can step outside of irony, much like pornography is absolutely absent a lot of irony, right? If you can just step out of irony, it's like, you know, you can laugh, but we're not joking. And for me, at that point where Joey DeMaio comes out and he starts using the liberal use of blood capsules on stage, I was like, I'm in. His crotch is bleeding on stage. Now, I don't know whether it's a blood capsule or he's really damaged himself to the extent that he's bleeding on stage, but whatever. I mean, they're clearly... You can laugh, and he was big and muscular enough so that you were like, clearly the guy's hitting the weights. There, you know, there was Thor. I mean, you've seen the documentary on the guy Thor, who was, you know, but it's like my whole thing with joke bands. You know, Man of War were not a joke band. They were all in. No, like Dave Winfield would do.
But they were not a joke band.
And they, and you could laugh at them at your own peril, you know, like Dave Windorf's first band, Shrapnel, you know. They were kind of a joke band, but this Man of War was not, and I didn't find it to be so.
No, and the thing they don't mention though is that Ross, the boss, the guitar player they're talking to, was a member of the Dictators, which was a big early punk band in New York before the Ramones. And for people who were there at the time, they've got this legendary status. For me, who heard the Ramones for several years and heard about the Dictators before we finally got our hands on the Dictators record. And then it sounded to me like Hotel California or something compared to the Ramones. I mean, it just did not deliver, and I was super disappointed. And it, you know, just didn't make any sense. Like, what's the big deal about the Dictators? But they were a big deal in the scene, in CBGBs, in New York, before the Ramones, before the Talking Heads, before, you know, anybody except maybe television. And so that, I think that's worth a mention there, that Man of War had this you know, punk rock legit connection. Then we get into kind of they jump, because they'd already talked about Blind Guardian and I'm forgetting the name of that other. They talked about Blind Guardian and Hammerfall, which were the two bands that broke power metal big. Blind Guardian's more like the band that carried the torch through the 90s, through the early 90s, and then Hammerfall's the one that suddenly got big in the late 90s. But then they've already covered them. We talked about them in the first segment. Now they come to these like last more recent bands with Dragon Force, which to me was just a Guitar Hero band. I didn't even know they had an audience outside Guitar Hero. And they're the Guitar Hero band. It's like they were made in a lab to be the hardest level of Guitar Hero, you know? And it's hilarious stuff. They sure do play fast.
Yeah. It blew my mind when I had Guitar Hero, I was into it. And when that song came on, I was like, what the? And then, like, could you see the notes? Normally the notes come down like Tetris. Just imagine like Tetris if you haven't played Guitar Hero. Like Tetris, you got to match it. And then all of a sudden, you might have like some notes coming down here, and then Dragon Force is like what the what?
You could not wing it.
They just made the news today. Also, did you see this?
I did not. What?
Lee, I mean, it was if you subscribe to Metal Sucks, Axel Rosenberg's website, Herman had this moment live just recently where he tossed his guitar in this great dramatic moment. You know, he tosses his guitar to his guitar tech, and the guitar tech tosses one back, and he keeps playing, you know, and he tosses it to the guitar tech, and the guy dropped the guitar.
Oh.
Yeah, bad day for guitar tech. You know? No word as to if he...
You went mute, Eugene. You're talking, we lost your audio.
No, can't hear you.
We lost your audio, but he's cursing. But the thing about Dragon Force, and I thought it was funny, I had no idea that Herman Lee was in death metal bands before he was in Dragon Force, which is just hilarious because there's no room in death metal bands for the kind of shit he was trying to do. So I can see why they didn't get it. And I like the whole ethos of, well, they're going to hate us anyway. Let's make them really hate us, you know? And so, you know, but Dragon Force is, I mean, I don't think does anybody take Dragon Force seriously? Is it possible to take Dragon Force seriously? I mean, they're kind of fun if that's what you're into.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you now. So what else did you have to say about Dragon Force?
Nothing. The guy who called that interrupted the show is a guy dying from cancer, and I'm going to curse him the fuck out as soon as the show is over. So I don't give a fuck if you die from cancer. Stop calling me.
Mute your phone and just look at the number and call the guy back when it's convenient. You don't have to be ugly to your dying friend. All right, so next we talk about Nightwish. And this was the band I had the biggest turnaround on, because when I first saw them and when I first heard them, I thought this is the most unholy mix of like Jefferson or Starship and Dragon Force, and this is the worst possible thing that could happen. But after listening a little bit more, I'm kind of amused and intrigued. Like, it's super operatic, chick singer, it's definitely power metal, but the thing they left out was the Kate Bush influence. To me, what this is Kate Bush meets thrash metal or black metal even, but with slick, super slick production values. That's the thing about all the power metal bands, is they all have slick production values. I mean, even Man of War or Helloween would go for as slick as they could get on really cheap budgets.
And yet, not a famous, you don't have any of the Johns brothers like you did with Zeppelin, not a famous producer out of the bunch. It's interesting, right?
Well, it's not. To me, it's more, it's just a super desiccated production style. I mean, it's super clean, you know, and not necessarily, I don't think that's necessarily a positive, but some of them, like Blind Guardian, to me, sounded like black metal with better production values and singing instead of screeching. And, you know, so I was kind of interested by that. But the thing about Nightwish, though, biggest band to my knowledge to ever come out of Finland. Like, they had records that did like 9 million, and then it wraps up the show with this festival culture thing. And I think this is what explains why they did this episode. It's because of these Wacken Fests that were massive in Europe. I mean, like 85,000 people, and they would sell out in like 4 days, year after year after year. This lasted all the way up until 2019, when COVID put them on pause. And it's going to be a different era when they come back supposedly this year. But these Eurofests, this was a fucking institution, and this was big business. And so to me, that explains the whole, that's why they did this episode, because this was happening in the thick of that era when the people are going out to these festivals.
Americans don't really understand. Roadburn just kicked off in the Netherlands, and it's like Walter, whose name, unpronounceable Dutch last name, has done this thing, and it's huge. We played there 4 years ago, and I think we had, 8,000 people watching Oxbow, which you need to know is crazy, right? We've been trying to play Roadburn for years, and they wouldn't have us, and then they finally did, you know, and it was a pretty phenomenal, and that was not our biggest audience in Europe, man. We played a off festival in Poland in front of like 10,000 people. Again, Oxbow, You know, a guy saw us play at Villette Sonique in front of the guy who just called 7,000 people, and then flew to San Francisco and saw us play at a leather bar in the leather bar section of town in front of 30 people, and his mind was blown. The European festival reality is not, it doesn't, we don't have any kind of corollary here.
Mm. With Coachella and some of the EDM stuff at Vegas, but it's not the same. It's not these week-long campouts.
And not corporate.
No. Yeah, correct. Well, even though corporations are buying in, they're not controlling it. At this point, Lollapalooza is not at all what Perry had intended it to be. And Coachella, same thing. It was like the guys from Golden Voice, who were punk rock promoters, hardcore promoters initially, were involved in the early days. And that's gone. It's corporations calling the shots now.
Yeah, I mean, Coachella, I think, has officially jumped the shark, like from the feedback I'm seeing on this. But and the Wacken Fest,
Southwest too.
Mm. Oh yeah, South by Southwest jumped the shark when the kid drove over 11 people or whatever it was, and and the town was just like, "We're sick of this. This is too big."
The town.
Yeah, there were a lot of cranky old mates.
It died for me when Ray Davies was a keynote speaker. It's like, come on.
Hey, what's wrong with Ray Davies?
Right, I don't know, man. And then, I guess I wouldn't have minded.
Just
Ray
really
Davies
got him.
If the next year it wasn't like some high tech valley guy, and then I'm like, I see you guys working. If you'd gone Ray Davies and then gone David Bowie, I'd have been cool. But then they went Ray Davies like Steve Jobs or some shit like that. I'm like, I'm out.
Yeah, I think Twitter was debuted there the next year. So, yeah. All right. So to sum up power metal, and I gotta commend you, Eugene. You've overcome your personal bias here. Because the point of the show is not about personal taste. I'm covering all, like Rod McEwen or whatever. That was extremely painful for me to listen to Rod McEwen records and everything. But I ended up kind of appreciating it. And my goal with all this stuff is to get what is it people like about this stuff, you know? And so with this stuff, it's just goofy and fun. It's, I'm not a fan of these kind of journey style melodies. Eugene loves it now.
Much better than Cats. Yeah. He'll listen to it again and again and again.
Yeah. But to me, it's just goofy and fun. And especially if you get lyric prints. I mean, some of the stuff is extremely funny if you enjoy the Man of War style post-irony laughing at with the bands, And so any final thoughts on power metal?
Rock on. Right past bias. Don't stop, yeah, please.
So I guess you won't be buying tickets to Wacken Fest when they come back.
Wacken Fest. Oh. They do put the whack in Wacken Fest.
Yes. The one thing go ahead.
I have to say, the first time I played the Roadburn was with this band called Black Sun. And I understood why they had held Oxbow off so long, because Walter, the main guy who started it, who was like, the Dutch Perry Farrell, he talked about my performance with, he goes, it was just such a wonderful, happy vibe. And then Black Sun with Eugene played, and it was just, it's just a downer. I sang a song about being brutally raped by a dumpster, and they, everybody there was smoking a lot of weed, but they could hear the words, and then they were like, man, guy, I just roached everybody's buzz. And I think that's the difference. I just don't like fun, goofy times. That's it.
Yeah. And the one last thing I want to mention that did leave out Europe, the infamous hair metal synth band.
I loved
they
Europe.
They did play their song.
They did.
The whole album? Like, or just the single?
A couple of songs they had are good. Cherokee, oh, marching on the trail of tears.
I can't believe I've been hanging out with a Europe fan for 10 years. But they did have a marching band playing The Final Countdown by Europe at Wacken Fest, which I thought was perfect. The perfect presentation, xylophones and polkas and The Final Countdown. So, apologies to any power metal fans who tuned in. We've tried very hard to appreciate your stuff. And honestly, I felt like Blind Guardian was a discovery I was happy to make. I'm going to go back and listen to more Halloween, which I had not paid any attention to. I'll listen to some more Man of War again. And I totally dug going back through my Scorpions and Accept stuff. You know, like I never had the whole Scorpions catalog.
Get that first Alcatraz record too.
I will add that. I will definitely check that. And also the second one, because Steve Vai is as good as Yngwie, I think, and more creative. Yeah. And also the Dragon Force guys, one last thing. They played some crazy noises. They didn't just play super fast. They're hitting those whammy bars and you know, I thought they were having some creative stuff. But we'll be back next time to continue our discussion of the Metal Evolution series with the episode on prog metal, which I'm hoping you don't hate as much as you hated new metal and power metal, because prog metal's even harder for me to swallow. Much harder, probably, than either of those. But after that, we've got extreme metal coming up. So
all right, that's the payoff. Sure. I can make it. I can make it.
Yeah, we can make it through. All right. We'll see y'all next time.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi return to discuss progressive metal. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.